All right, so usually this is where I tell you about how I met this episode's guest and why I find them so interesting, you know, why you're listening in the first place. But this week, we can skip all of that. Gray and I decided that for our next editor profile, it was time we sit down with none other than Hodinkee editor, social media manager, manager of special projects, and I don't know what, all-around bright spot.
I was actually thinking about it. We're both hockey fans. You know who she is, I think, a little bit?
Who's Kara?
She's the glue guy.
Oh, she's the glue guy.
So for those who are not hockey fans, a glue guy is someone whose performance on the ice is important, but their real skill set is being the glue in the locker room. They hold the whole thing together.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. She is definitely the glue guy for this team. I get most of the glue. Kara and I share a desk. So
you guys are stuck together, for
sure. Yeah, for anybody who doesn't know already from the constant banter, Kara and I share a desk. I see a lot of Ms. Kara Barrett. You know, Kara has a really interesting story, and it's one I'm glad we can tell. She doesn't come to watches through journalism. She didn't even set out to end up in watches professionally. But she kind of ended up here through an interesting, strange, winding road that started in Switzerland in a certain way, took her to the U.S., took her to London, back to the U.S., back to London. You'll hear all about it, but it's a pretty interesting tale that I think gets at why the watch world is so fascinating.
And that kind of gets at one of my kind of overarching theories about Kara and her personality, which is that she is largely driven by people. She's a people person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whether it was the art that she studied in college through to the watches that she now works with today, they're all kind of a means of ingress to learning about and getting to interact with people.
Absolutely. And it's a good fit for this show because, at least in theory, I guess, that's what the show is all about.
In theory.
Yeah, that's what we say, at least. We also recorded this on Kara's birthday, so there's some gift giving, some wine pouring, and quite a bit of silliness, but...
It's a good one.
Yeah, I think if it's half as fun to listen to as it was for us to make, I think everybody's in for a treat.
There we go, yes, we've done our job, if that's the case.
So without further ado, I'm your host, Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is presented by Zenith Watches. Stay tuned later in the show for the story of how the El Primero Caliber was almost lost to history until it was saved by a savvy watchmaker who knew what was at stake. You can also visit zenith-watches.com to learn more. This is a pretty special episode.
Why?
I mean, first of all, we got you,
yeah?
Ms. Kara Barrett, Woo. In the studio.
Hello.
We also got Greg Corjon in here.
What's up, everybody?
This is the Dream Team.
Dream Team. I love working with you two.
Yeah. The famous Greg Corjon.
This is the best.
From behind the scenes to in the scenes.
Yeah, I think there's a threshold to fame that you two maybe have eclipsed. I'm working my way up.
Don't think so.
You'll get there someday, young Corjon.
I'm looking forward to it.
Everybody's been asking for you in the comment section.
There's been one guy asking for me in the comment section.
It only takes one.
Gray has one super fan.
Shout out to you, my one super fan, not my mom.
As
you know, I legitimately texted her after that comment was made. I was like, Jane, I love you. You need to stop. Turns out
she
doesn't read Hodinkee as closely as she told me she did. Mm. So
My dad has a fake account that he comments under.
He's got a Finsta?
He has a pseudonym.
Oh, what is that's it? Amazing.
I can't tell.
We gotta go figure this out.
What's your dad's name?
Andrew Barrett.
Shout out to Andrew Barrett.
Okay.
What's up, Dad?
I'll keep an eye out.
It's not Andrew Barrett. That's not the...
All right. Okay. We're burying the lead here.
Okay.
It's Kara's birthday.
Happy birthday, Kara.
Happy birthday. We can't sing you happy birthday because that song costs like 20 grand and we don't have the budget for that, but happy birthday.
Thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
To celebrate, we got some wine. You want to pour some wine for us, Kara?
I sure do.
Your own birthday
Sponsored
wine?
Sponsored by Savvy B.
We're drinking New Zealand's finest here.
Oyster Bay.
This counts as a gift if I don't expense it, right?
You can take the girl out of South Carolina, but you can't take South Carolina.
It counts as a gift if you expense it.
Okay, fair enough.
You wanna top me up there?
I got you.
Captain, a nice Tammy Taylor pour there.
Mm-hmm. What's that in your hand, Stevie?
This is a birthday gift.
Oh my gosh, you guys!
We had to do something for you. Come on. You're coming on the show.
Is it a signed copy of your book?
It is not a signed copy of my book. It is a much better book than my book.
Oh, you guys. Okay, just for the viewers out there, or listeners?
Listeners.
All the above.
It's radio.
It's called Next Level Basic. It's a book by Stassi Schroeder from Vanderpump Rules. If you don't watch it, maybe you should.
Yeah, get your life right.
Thank you, guys. That's so sweet. Oh, I can't wait to read it.
Now, Kara, I also tried to order you a gift. It has not arrived yet. Shout out to the people at Amazon Fulfillment who screwed me.
Sweet.
Uh-oh.
Thanks,
but,
guys.
They are some lovely embroidered Norwich Terrier socks.
Oh.
As we both share love for the cute little terriers that are...
Norwich Terriers are the best.
That originate from Norwich.
Shout out to Sybil and Fiona.
And Rags and Rosie.
What up?
Oh,
see,
man.
Maybe this episode my mom will listen to. Her dog's got a shout out.
I got a different kind of terrier. Sorry, guys. I'm out of the club on this
Equally
one.
Equally cute.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right.
Anyways, cheers. Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Happy birthday, CB.
Thank you. Clink, clink.
So
clink,
if you're worried about this episode being nothing but like inside references and us talking about ourselves, we're off to a rip-roaring start.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Here welcome we welcome to the party.
Okay, so what is this podcast really about?
It's all about you.
Yeah.
It's CBD.
All
CBD.
About you.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
well,
let's
that's,
go.
I'm nervous.
You don't be nervous. Why are you nervous?
Because I had 3 Diet Cokes and 2 cups of coffee today.
Mm.
So I'm feeling a little jittery.
Okay.
It's a chemical
but,
thing.
That's what
yeah.
the wine's for.
There you go.
All right. Let's start, let's go back to the source. Where are you from?
Well, a little known fact is, well, it, maybe it's, a, I don't know, it's a little known fact, I was actually born in Zurich, Switzerland. So I like to think that watches were my destiny because
okay.
I was
okay.
born in Switzerland and now I work almost exclusively with Swiss people in a
True.
Swiss industry. So... that's a little story about me. But I was only here for 2.5 years, and they wouldn't give me citizenship. They're very.
Why were you born in Zurich? What was going on?
It was just my dad's job was over there.
Nice.
And so they moved there. My parents moved there from Dubai in the 80s, if you can imagine. I won't give away what year I was born, because I don't want to. A lady never tells her age.
Okay.
But, yeah, I was lived there for 2.5 years, and then I moved to London after that.
Wait, you lived in London?
Yes, I did. The running joke is I tell everybody that I lived in London because I'm an Anglophile. Just ask all my coworkers and my best friends. They will remind you. But yeah, so I was there until I was 9, and then I moved to South Carolina after that. And that's the beginning. And I lived there until I went to school in Dallas.
Texas forever.
Texas forever. Stevie, fun fact, is from Austin, Texas.
True story.
And so, yeah, so I went to SMU, and I was there, and I studied art history. And
didn't you want to be like an engineer or something though
yeah.
first?
I started off as an engineering major, which kind of blows people's minds.
What kind of engineering?
It was vague because okay. I lasted 1 year.
The science kind?
The science kind. It was yeah. supposed to be civil. And then I was going to double it up with art because I liked painting and drawing, but I like decided that I didn't have the math skills or the passion to study art, so I switched to art history last minute.
What was the final straw that reminded you that maybe math wasn't your strong suit?
When I failed calculus 2.
Yeah,
sweet.
And that was my second semester calculus, and I was like, oh, because I did really well in high school in calculus. I, you know, took the AP classes, and I did really well, and I loved it. And then the second semester just really got me, and I like went to extra help and all of that stuff, and it just wasn't sticking. And you know, like you're stupid when you're 18, so you're kind of like. I'd rather be socializing than like studying calculus. So I'll just be an art history major like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So
like
that's
everybody
basically
else,
basically what I did.
Right.
So, but it worked out fine. You know, I'm here now with you guys. So,
what's your favorite period in art history?
Like,
what's your favorite period in the history of art?
I really like this one period in London, and it's the like Auerbach and Freud. And I think, what are they called? I can't even remember. It's been so long. I have to look it up. We'll link it up in the notes. But I think it's called, like, the London School.
Okay.
And so, like, they came up in a time, like, a post-war England. And so I feel like a lot of that kind of, like, you know, kind of if you think about England after the war, they're, like, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And, like, they're really, it was, like, a really kind of quiet country. And they were just kind of trying to rebuild. So I think a lot of artistic... abilities came out of that because there was literally nothing to do and when you were growing up and people kind of rebelled. And so I think the artists at the same time really reflected that in their kind of like the way that like they painted, and it was like very expressive and interesting. Kind of gross if you think about it, because like Bacon was like pretty disturbed.
Bacon's
as well.
The best.
As well as
Bacon's the best.
As well as Auerbach and Freud. But yeah, I really like that genre so much that I can't remember the name of the.
That's cool.
The name of it, but
I don't know what it's called, but it's my favorite.
That's what the show notes are for.
It's not my strong suit.
Making vague references to things and then making Gray look it up after the fact.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what you're here for, sir.
Exactly. So yeah. How about you, Stevie? What's your favorite genre?
That's my favorite. Wait. This is not how this interview goes, but...
Enough about me.
These days, an Apex guy. Abstract Expressionism.
Okay, good. I'm glad you clarified what that was.
Yeah, Stevie's like, don't make me talk about art. Oh, please don't make me talk about art.
I don't want to talk about art.
Apex.
We'll talk about art. All right, so moving on. This is not about me, not today. So you studied art history.
Yes.
And then you ended up back in London, right?
Yes. I went to London after I graduated to intern at Christie's on King Street in the house sale department.
House sale department?
Yes. And it's not what you think it is. It's not real estate. It was...
That'd be too easy.
Good to know.
Way too easy. Which they do have their own real estate arm, but it's like a different company. But house sales was the sale of estates. So anyone that passed away or was getting divorced or like didn't want to have any of their things anymore would just sell off like everything in their house. So it could be a contemporary painting, it could be a piece of furniture, it could be a piece of pottery, silver, you name it.
And by houses, you mean like we're talking like old piles, right? We're talking like big old Palladian mansions out in the country.
Or the one that I worked on was a Cotswold. It was like an antique kind of this guy who was like the king of antiques. I can't remember his name. I have a terrible memory. But he had this house in the Cotswolds and it was just filled with so much stuff. I mean, so much stuff.
Like hoarder level stuff?
It was like, it was like borderline hoarder, but like nice. Like, it was, like
hoarders meets stuff. Antique roadshow.
You can still be a hoarder with expensive shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, like, he had collected all these, like, really cool things. And so what, as an intern, which I felt very, like, special to be an intern at, you know, Christie's London, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, it's a prestigious place.
And so I went out, and it was, like, I spent the night out in the Cotswolds, and I spent two full days, like, tagging objects. So, like, we had the valuation, and then I had to, like, go through and, like, match up the number and, like, find the object and, like, tag it. Huh. And then it would be brought back to Christie's in London, and then they would have the sale, and they would put it all up. So
it sounds like that's, like, a great department to be introduced to because it's such a wide selection of things that you're looking at.
Yeah. It was just tons of objects.
Yeah.
And I've always had kind of, like, a, you know, I've always liked things, whether they be like big, small, doesn't
right.
know, fancy, not like it just was really kind of
learning about
eye-opening.
Them, the context around them.
Yeah, exactly.
What was the coolest thing that you ran across in that first foray into the auction world?
It wasn't so much like one specific thing, but it was just crazy to see all the different types of furniture that you were exposed to and how like in England, they are so particular about their periods and like they all switch from like whoever was king or queen at the time and then they kind of Edwardian, Georgian, like all this stuff and they all had like tiny little nuances and then they would like get things from like neoclassical from like earlier times and it was just really interesting to be working somewhere where they took that so seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of similar to watches in the sense that over there they were just so passionate about preserving historical objects and learning about them, knowing about them, cataloging them. Like I remember I would go into like the library and they would have just, like, drawers and drawers and drawers and drawers and drawers of, like, card files where I would literally have to go in and, like, there would be one of, like, console. And I would have to, like, find the console drawers. And I would, like, have to open the drawer and then, like, flip through and find one that was similar to the object that we were researching. And then it had all the information of, like, when it was sold. And it was all on paper. Like, this was not a
total
digital record.
Treasure hunt.
It was really kind of crazy. And I think now it's kind of obviously, I think, hopefully has moved to more digital, but they still reference that stuff at auction houses, which is really, really weird, but like kind of nice. It's like refreshing to like hold something, a physical record rather than having to like just like Google it.
Totally.
So that was a really kind of like a cool time. And also like the people I worked with were so eccentric. They were like these like crazy like English like lords and like viscounts and like.
Did you work for a lord?
I didn't work for a lord, but I worked for someone who was married to a marquess who lived in a castle that I visited later when I was getting my master's degree. So it was literally went and toured his home to like learn about the different periods of things. And he was so eccentric. His name was Orlando Rock.
Orlando Rock?
Yeah. And he was so nice, man. And he was really funny. And he would like roll into we had this tiny office and it was so hot. And he would roll in on his rollerblades because he would roll in from Notting Hill.
Wait. Again, buried the lead here. Orlando Rock rolled the Marquess rollerbladed to work?
He would rollerblade in from Notting Hill and he would keep his rollerblades on until at least after lunch. And he would just sit at his desk and he would like hit his mouse on the table like every time he was trying to like email or like do something, and it was just so fun. He'd be like, "Ugh, this thing," and he'd like get so annoyed with it, and he would just like roll his feet under his desk so like you could hear it. And then it was like mid-July and they decided to clean the outside of the building and they covered it in like scaffolding, and he was going on his like summer vacation or summer holiday for like a month, so it didn't affect him, but it affected me and the other people that were staying there. And there was no air conditioning and it was like 95 degrees outside, and he called the like the HR whoever was the operations people that were like dealing with it, and he was like, "How long is this scaffolding going to be up?" they were like, "Oh, like through the rest of the summer." He was like, "Oh, it's as hot as fucking Calcutta in here." And then like clicked on the phone and I was just like 22 yeah. or like 22. And I was just like, who is like, where yeah. am I? Like,
yeah. Where's Calcutta?
Exactly. I had to like Google. And I was like,
has he been to Calcutta?
I was like, oh, it's in India. Got it.
In India.
So it was a really kind of like eye-opening experience, like working with like really eccentric characters who.
That's amazing.
Kind of like are out of a movie. So it was fun. I enjoyed it. But I was shipped back after 6 months because my visa ran out. Mm.
Christie's couldn't get your visa renewed?
No, they were very stingy.
Yeah, what a bunch of
I also was just an intern.
So you get shipped back. What happens when you're shipped back?
I wallowed around because I missed London so much. And then I applied to grad school because this was like right after 2008. And so there were no jobs.
Yeah.
And so, especially for art history majors. But guess what? My dad reminded me that there were engineering jobs after 2008.
How kind of him. How kind.
Damn, I was like, well, coulda, woulda, shoulda. Oh, well. But yeah, so then I applied to grad school and I went to the Sotheby's Institute back in London, basically to go back to London, but also because they had a really kind of robust object-focused program where you studied ceramics, painting, furniture. And that was really cool, too, because it was like a two-year program and you basically just kind of went and toured like these estates and like learned about everything in them and then wrote about them and then had like mock auctions and then had a brief stint working for a contemporary art dealer. I was a terrible personal assistant. It lasted not very long.
You were
long.
Working what, like the front desk at a gallery?
No, I was one of the director's assistants.
Okay.
And I was actually just reminiscing about one of my jobs. I had to print out all of her emails and alphabetize them in binders.
What?
And then I had to archive them in the emails, and I was like, oh my God.
This person classic sounds like
intern stuff.
I was an assistant.
Printing and alphabetizing emails?
Yeah, and I had to like book her
That's
flights.
A thing
I really
a
was a terrible.
Does.
Honestly, if anyone wants to hire me as an assistant, they should not. I was a really terrible
Look elsewhere. Good to know.
I was a really terrible assistant. So that didn't last very long, and then I moved to New York after that.
Okay. And so coming out of Sotheby's, coming out of grad school.
Yeah.
Did you have a sense of like what department you wanted to work in at an auction house? Did you want to go back to an auction house? Like what was kind of the plan there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was funny because everyone who went to that program really wanted to work at an auction house. And I kind of didn't. I kind of was like, oh, like I did that. Like I would be open to it, but I kind of wanted to see what else is out there, which is why I ended up at the gallery. And then when I moved to New York, I was like, okay, well, I got to find a job. So like, I don't. First place auction house, it's like the only experience I have, like I need to get this locked down. And so I applied to their floater program, which is like a temp program, and they move you around different departments, and they gave it to me, and I was like one of the few people in my program that actually ended up working at an auction house. I think I was like one of one, like which was really wild.
Testament to you.
I'm not really sure. I think my internship definitely helped prior to that, but I think I don't really know, like, what happened there, but.
But, I mean, like, you had a pretty, you know, A to B path. Once Calc 2 occurred, this was the world that you wanted to occupy in a little bit.
Yeah, I always loved art, and I always really liked learning about that stuff and working with it.
Yeah.
kind of, you know, any, you know, which is how I ended up with watches. But so there I started working in their marketing department in their loyalty program called Preferred, which kind of dealt with like events and VIPs and things like that.
Yeah.
And that lasted 10 months. And then a job opened up in the watch department. And I was like, oh, I was like, that's pretty cool. Maybe I'll apply to that. And then I did. And I got the cataloger position. And then that's where it started.
So did you, before that, did you know anything about watches? Did you own a watch? Were you like interested in watches? Or was this kind of a whim?
It was.
Or both?
It was both. It was a whim because it was available. But I had always noticed watches. I like was given a Cartier Tank when I graduated from high school. And like that was, I wanted that since I was like 16. Like it was like a very kind of, I always looked at people's watches and was curious about them. I don't think I had the same kind of like deep dive inclination that a lot of people have in this industry, but I really did always gravitate to them and know it was like brand aware. Mm-hmm. So that is kind of what, when the watch department opened up, I was like, oh, like that would be interesting. Like I didn't know you could work in watches. Like I thought that they were just things that you could buy.
Did you immediately associate the same things that you liked about these other objects that you studied? Did you see that in watches, kind of like the social context, the provenance?
Yeah, exactly. And like soon it was kind of like, oh, there are all these different kinds of watches and they vary ever so slightly, but like so vastly that it just really became very fascinating. And then I remember one of my colleagues like taught me about the perpetual calendar and I was like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. I was like, that is wild. Like, I can't believe that there's a little tiny machine on your wrist that can account for a leap year.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, you know, for a lot of us who do this either professionally or who are watch collectors or into watches, it's easy to forget about that first moment that you realize that a watch could be something not just beautiful, but like something impressive and interesting. Mm-hmm. And that like, holy shit, this thing tracks leap years. Like that moment is really special. And like, honestly, I'm trying to think back and like, I don't remember what that moment was for me. And I'm trying to like figure it out. But do you, Gray, do you have that moment?
Oh, do I ever? Because
perfect.
You know, like Cara, I think I was brand aware. I looked at watches. My dad wore a watch. I wore, you know, Timex, et cetera. And at the time that I first started Hodinkee, I was wearing a Timex chronograph. Shout out to Timex. Love that watch dearly. The chronograph did not work for shit. And so one of the very first things I did for
Timex.
Sorry, Timex. It probably was me, you know, wearing it throughout college and banging it and not taking care of it. The battery probably wasn't even in the watch at that point. So not Timex's fault. User error entirely.
All right.
Fast forwarding to the first assignment I really had with Hodinkee, which was doing photos at the Vacheron LE release that we did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And seeing, I think it was JJ Redick, use the chronograph function and asking Will as an aside what exactly that function was and understanding that a chronograph functions properly when you could start, stop, and reset as you could not do on my normal Timex. So very basic introduction to what complications were and kind of took off from there. But that, I mean, you know, that's such an impressive, beautiful watch. And that was my kind of introduction.
That's a good first impression, I would say, that watch.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that and then also introduction to the world that Hodinkee occupies.
Right.
When you walk in and, you know, JJ Redick, a player that I've been looking up to for a while, is standing right there in the living room.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And wants to meet you because you're part of Hodinkee at that point. Right.
And a introduction that I completely blew, quick aside.
This is a great story.
Yeah, Will Holloway, my boss, lovely gentleman, director of content, introduced me to JJ Redick saying, this is our new video employee. JJ, I'd love you to meet him. I look up into JJ Redick's beautiful eyes, 6'6", like, and I just see the highlights that I've watched of his entire career flashing before me, and I introduce myself as JJ Redick.
Stop!
He's like, hey, what's up, man?
I don't know that story.
And I said, hi, I'm JJ. And JJ looks back at me and says, no, you're not.
And Will and I look at each other just like,
who is this kid?
Oh, fuck.
Quickly corrected course, introduced myself as Gray, and scurried away as fast as I could.
It was amazing. Oh, my God. I love that story.
Pretty great.
That's great. Stevie, remember your moment.
You know, I think, you know, talking about the Hodinkee moment where, like, I realized that this place was something special and something really crazy was maybe my second day on the job. It was Ben and me full time. Will was freelancing at the time. It was the first time I think I met Will. It must have been the first time I met Will. And Ben, Will, and I met in Midtown at Mike Safdie's old store, Madison Fine Time, but the old location, which at the time was brand new. And we were shooting a video with Mike that we'll link it up. And great with the smile every time I say link it up. I'll even send you the URL for this one. We're shooting at Mike Safdie's place, and Will and I are there, and like Ben knows what we're doing. I have no idea. There is an extra set of hands. Will's shooting everything. And as we go to leave at the end of the day, Ben's like, what do you think about what you saw today? I was like, oh, it seems cool. Yeah. He's like, you know, you'll probably never see that many amazing paddocks in one place ever again, right? And I was like, no, I had no idea. He's like, how much do you think those watches cost? Like all of them put together. I was like, I don't know, like $100,000? And Ben like laughed at me, like legitimately just laughed at me and was like, try like tens of millions. Like we're handling like unique, custom ordered, you know, grand comps from Patek.
Yeah.
As if it's nothing. Like yeah. I was too ignorant at the time to have any idea that what I was handling was special. And that kind of like casual interaction with really special things and really interesting people, I think is one of the most interesting things about what we get to do, is that those things are in a lot of ways like very commonplace for us in a way that we're very spoiled.
Right.
And it's a nice way to kind of get to interact with this world that can sometimes be like very stuffy and kind of like everything's behind glass and all of that. And
yeah.
Instead we get to kind of just like experience it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
So back to CB. You're a watch cataloger now.
Yeah, I'm a watch cataloger now.
What does that mean? Like, how does a watch department at an auction house work? Because okay. I think that's something people, for the most part, don't know. Like, they see a catalog, they see the auctioneer up on the rostrum, and, like, that's it. And some people right. over in the phone bank. And, like, other than that, they have no idea.
So something I think that people don't appreciate about the auction houses, especially when it comes to watches, is watches out of the entire structure of an auction house are pretty small. Like, you've got contemporary, you have impressionist. Those are like the biggest departments that make all the money. They keep the lights on.
Yeah, and like one, like we saw last week, right? Like the week before we're recording this, like a Monet sold for $101 million.
Yeah.
Like the watch department.
A good watch sale would make $17 million.
Right. Like there are, most of the watch departments don't do $100 million
in
a year.
Of course not. No.
You know?
And it's a hustle. Like, your entire, when you're not selling the watches, you're consigning them. Hmm. And it's reaching out to people. It's reaching out to clients.
Oh, yeah.
It's
they like, have to come from somewhere, I guess. Right.
Right. Exactly. And, like, it's so funny when people are like, oh, like, so-and-so is such a terrible sale this, you know, this season. And it's like, it's luck. And it's, like, relationship nurturing. And, like, it is a grind. So, like, basically, your entire, you know, I would say, 8 months out of the year, you're sourcing, and the rest you're creating a sale and a catalog. And so my job as a cataloger wasn't initially to consign, but like if someone called and I picked up the phone that day, or like I met with them in the, you know, lobby, then I would help with consignments that way. So I was responsible for organizing all the photography and writing up all the descriptions. And the specialist would join in and help with like bigger pieces, but like if it was like a Datejust, like that was me. I was like kind of looking them up, learning about the calibers, writing them up. And it's all very formulaic, so it kind of becomes very repetitive very quickly.
But you learn a lot, I'm sure, right?
You learn a lot, but you really learn more with the like highlights. So like the Graves Super Complication, or like the Titanium Collection, or like the Breguet Saint Batique, which was like the most like random sale I ever worked on, but was
were
like,
you there for the Titanium Collection?
I was. That was my favorite.
Interesting. Can you tell people about that? I remember on the other side, on the media side, like that was another like holy shit moment.
That was crazy. So it was a consignor that had been working with Sotheby's a lot, and they came to us with this collection of, I think it was like 12 custom titanium watches from Patek Philippe. And they range from the Sky Moon Tourbillon to this officer case with Breguet numerals with a table cut perfect diamond on the case back. And you could see the movement through the diamond. So like instead of having like a sapphire crystal case
guys,
back.
Guys, Gray's eyes just rolled so far back in his head, they're through the wall.
He might have almost fallen out of his chair. I don't know. It was crazy. And we, like, got this one. And we, like, took the diamond out to get it, like, tested because the jewelry department was like, oh, my God, you guys have to, like, get this GIA certified. Like, this is, like, the, like, most insane diamond. I have pictures of it, like, on my hand. Like, it was just like, oh, my God, this is, like, the most beautiful stone I've ever seen. And you could see the movement through it. Mm. And so...
It's so awesome. Yeah,
then there really was a series, and these were kind of the best. They had these, like, hieroglyphics on the dial. And we were really nervous about including them because they were gifts for people, and they said their names in the hieroglyphics. And last minute, they were pulled from the sale because of that. And the best part was, is, like, we were we, like, knew who they were, but we, like, didn't think about the fact that people could, like, just Google it and, like... After being like, and that was on me, and I was like, huh. I was like, well,
suppose you could have done that.
Like, yeah, because if you can see it, you can Google it and figure it out. And that was kind of like a big commentary, like, on working. And, like, you are dealing with 300 watches per sale. Yeah. You're dealing with 300 boxes per sale. You're dealing with 300 certificates per sale. Mm. You have to get extracts for every single one. You have to match the numbers to the watch because, oh, by the way, sometimes they send you an extract and the numbers don't match the watch, which means the watch isn't original or, like, they messed up. And so it turned into this whole thing where it's so many moving parts. And then you have to make sure, like, you don't have, like, two of the same watches, like, in the catalog by accident, or, like, two descriptions that, like, are repeated because they pulled accidentally incorrectly from the... So it's all these, like, tiny little things you have to keep track of. I remember what I said about being a bad personal assistant? It was very stressful and, like, a really...
I can see the PTSD flashback in your eyes right now.
Yeah. It was, like, a really good learning experience.
You're just talking faster and faster as you go through this.
As her heart rate...
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm, like, getting kind of sweaty just even thinking about it. But, like, it was so stressful around that time, but it was such a good learning experience because it really taught you that, like, there were consequences to not catching these things early. Yeah. And, like, you better believe that there were mistakes after that catalog were printed. And, like, oh, you better believe that, like, people were upset. And it wasn't even your boss that was upset. The consigners were upset. So it would be like, oh, you have, like, a $3,000 watch in this sale. Like, they're mad that you made a mistake on their watch. It doesn't matter. Like, you have to be really mindful of that.
Is there a certain adrenaline, though, that comes along, obviously, with working in such a high-pressure environment where you have this buildup?
Yeah. Like, our sales were in December and June, and every May and November, I would lose approximately 7 pounds. And, like, it was just, like, all you did was work. Like, you were there from, like, 9 to 9, 9 to 11 for, like, the entire month leading up to the sale.
You hated it in the moment. Do you look back fondly on those memories? Did you enjoy the process?
Yeah, I mean, the rush was part of the fun. Right. And then, like, once the sale was done and it did well or it didn't do well, like, it was exciting. Mm-hmm. And, like, I was young enough to enjoy it. And so, like, it was really kind of, like, thrilling to... And also, like, I was aware that, like, working at an auction house like that, it was, like, a big deal. Like, people back home thought it was cool. And, like, I, like, was really appreciative that I could experience that and, like, really be a part of, like, a bigger thing. And, like, that, to me at the time, was, like, very, like, meaningful.
Nice.
And, like, it was just fun. And, like, I really liked the people I worked with. Like, they were, like, all very, like, quirky and into watches. And, like, it was just a good time. Like, you became really close because you were dealing with, like, all these crazy people.
Want to give a few shout outs?
Yeah, I want to say hi to Darren Schnipper.
Yeah,
Katie
Darren.
Thomas, Nate Borgelt, and then my friend Lizzie Griesedick, who was there. She was so funny. She was from the Midwest. She used to talk to people for hours about their contracts, but it was just so funny. She was just really great. But yeah, and, like, Darren is, like, this, like, powerhouse that's, like, been in the industry forever, and she's, like, she's so funny. She couldn't pronounce my name to save her life until I quit. Which was, like, she would call me Kara.
Interesting.
And then when I quit, she would call me Kara.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of a power move.
For all those out there.
Yeah.
This is the correct pronunciation.
Correct.
Kara.
Yeah.
Like a car.
Were you there for the Graves Fullerton sale, or was it after that?
I joined right after that.
Okay.
But I was there when the super complication came back, and I was responsible for babysitting that bad boy.
Right. I think that might have been the first time we met.
Yeah, I think it was.
Was around the super complication.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was a hot watch.
That thing was a crazy hot watch. Yeah, completely crazy.
What does babysitting it entail?
Just making sure that, like, nobody else touches it.
Literally, like, get your hands off
this
watch.
Like, if we're photographing it, like, I'm with it. Mm-hmm. I'm picking it up like nobody else's.
Do you sleep with it under your pillow?
No, they wouldn't let me take it home.
Lame.
Unfortunately. But that was also crazy to see all the, how, like, all those complicated, like, to this day, I couldn't even tell you what all the complications were because there were so many. Like, I think there were 24.
Great. We got to change the pop quiz from later. She said she doesn't know.
Oh. Yeah, I was supposed to list all the complications? Well, I think there's, I know there are 24.
I don't know we're going to fill the next 25, 30 minutes then.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. All right, well. But that thing was crazy.
Yeah, it was wild.
And then they sold it in Geneva and they didn't let me go to the sale.
Ooh. Will and I were in the room for that sale.
And then the consigner died.
Just so you know, Stephen was at that sale, by the way.
I was waiting to see if you were going to pick that one up. All right, yeah.
Oh, Stevie, so special.
Yeah, Will and I were there, man. And now a look at this week's sponsor. The El Primero chronograph caliber is a staple of modern watchmaking, and it has been since it was first introduced in 1969. It's the original high-speed automatic chronograph, and it's hard to imagine the watch landscape without it. However, in the mid-1970s, we almost lost the El Primero forever. When a new owner took over Zenith Watches, they decided to focus on quartz production. This was the height of the quartz crisis, remember. Whole manufacturer buildings were shut down and condemned. Equipment was sold off, old movements were thrown away, and valuable records disappeared. Luckily, the El Primero had a savior. His name was Charles Vermont, and he was a watchmaker born and raised in the Valley de Joux. He understood just how important the El Primero was, and he smartly dismantled some of the original production equipment and hid it in an attic, along with the documents necessary to create the movements. It would take almost 10 years, but eventually, someone at Zenith found Vermont's treasure, and the manufacturer was able to resume production of the El Primero, setting off more than three decades of continued innovation based on that illustrious caliber. On the occasion of the El Primero's 50th anniversary, it's nice to think of Charles Vermont and just how lucky we are that he knew what was at stake and had the gumption to do something about it. Here's to you, Charles. To learn more about the El Primero, visit zenith-watches.com. All right, let's get back to the show.
Can we get a top three kind of like memories from that period of your life? Top three sales, top three anecdotes?
I like that. Do it as a countdown. 3, 2, 1.
Okay, I was just going to say, not in any particular order, but Stevie's the boss.
Yeah. Pressure time.
I can tell some like good moments and some bad moments to like even it out.
All right.
Here we go.
Let's do it.
So I would say that the Super Convocation obviously was a highlight. The Titanium Collection, also a highlight. Consigning my first major watch, which was a 3970, which is why I have a soft spot for them.
Nice.
Unfortunately, I had to lower the estimate before the sale, and the consigner was unhappy about that. But leading up, it was great.
Did it sell?
It sold. Barely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It sold.
It went really well until we had to sell it.
It's fine. It sold.
But the market was soft at that point, so it was kind of hard. So
Stevie, who's great at reference numbers, I'm sure is familiar with 3970. Can you tell me about the 3970?
It's a perpetual calendar chronograph from Patek, and it was made for a really long period of time, but it's kind of like their modern... I don't know. How would you describe it?
It's like, sort of like the first modern... perpetual calendar.
Yeah, chronograph. But it has like a very vintage feel to it. Like it still feels kind of old.
It's still, what, 36 nice. Millimeters? 38?
Yeah, I think it's 36.
Yeah, it's little. It's really elegant.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It's cool. I wrote a long article about it, so I should know more. But it comes in white gold, pink gold, yellow gold, and platinum. I think there's one steel.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know my Patek that well. Sorry.
There was no titanium one, though. I do know that.
The titanium, is it just me, or wasn't the finish on the titanium really weird, too?
It was it matte.
But it was almost like, it had like almost like a sandy, like, graininess to it.
It was
really weird.
Yeah, that was such a wild sale.
Yeah.
Those were crazy, because they were also light.
Yeah, and then one had a giant diamond in the back of it.
Yeah, that's my dream watch. I wonder where that watch is right now. They wouldn't tell me who bought
it. Honestly, nowhere good. Let's be real.
It was funny because, like, you could access, like, who bought what and, like, who's... Oh, there was this crazy one. And John Goldberg actually just posted it recently. It was this massive time-only Patek that was in yellow gold with a black dial. And it was huge. And it was so cool. And it was from, like, the 60s. And it measured, like, 44 millimeters, which was so big for the time. Mm-hmm. And it was, was such a cool
this
watch.
Is the,
that was
yeah,
my
yeah,
first
yeah.
sale. That was my first sale, and
we
that was crazy.
We did a Hodinkee event around that
I think
watch.
You did.
I have on my Instagram somewhere a photo
there.
Of that watch.
It's so cool. We'll link that one up.
Goldberger has that watch?
I don't know, but he posted it on Instagram.
Interesting. So that watch is incredible.
I wonder if he is the owner of that
watch. It's like
watch.
A dinner plate. It's huge. It's huge and super thin.
And it's time only.
Yeah. It's incredible.
It was...
We'll find a photo of that and link that up,
too. I have a picture of my wrist, and it's like it goes over my wrist.
It's so cool.
And for that time, it was just like massive. Like, it was the 96 was in production at that time. Yeah. Like, that's what was the norm.
Should we talk about what kind of watches Carl was wearing at this stage of life?
Yeah, let's do that. And then I want to ask you one more auction house question. Then we'll find out how you ended up at Hodinkee.
Yeah.
But what watches were you wearing at that stage?
At that time, I was wearing a Cartier Roadster.
Okay.
All day, every day.
Okay.
And I loved it because you could change the strap.
You're the man.
Anybody else need anything?
All good. Thank you. Did you text him to get the beer?
I did. I didn't want to miss a moment of this. I'm like,
can we leave that in, please? We'll keep it moving.
Okay. Yeah. So I was wearing a Cartier Roadster at that time.
Okay.
Loved it.
So
all day, every day.
Before we get to your Hodinkee turn.
Sure.
One thing I want to ask about is new property, right? So something we're seeing a lot of in the auction world now is the same watches are coming up over and over again. Or the watch comes up and it hasn't been at auction in a couple years, but everybody kind of in the community knows it's changed hands 12 times amongst dealers and whatever. And it's essentially like anybody kind of like quote unquote in the know knows that this watch has been around and somehow over the last 12 months it doubled in price and nobody quite knows how and blah, blah, blah. But the real success for auction houses comes when they find new property.
Yes.
Right? That's how auction houses became important was they were essentially back in the day, they were how new property got introduced to the market.
Yes.
Was when you were at Sotheby's, was that something you guys talked about a lot or was it just something kind of in the background?
It's something you always hope and wish for. You hope that that one phone call is going to be someone who found a 6263 untouched in their drawer.
Yeah.
And like it was their father's and they never wore it. And so there was one time in particular, and I've talked about it before on the site, I think, is... There was a random call from New Jersey, and Nate answered the phone. And it was a family who was like, yeah, I have this really weird clock, and it says Cartier on it. Like, it was my grandfather's. He passed away. We don't know what to do with it. Like, can we send you pictures? And they sent pictures of it, and it turned out to be this, like, one-of-a-kind, ornate stone tortoise.
This is the turtle clock.
Wow. And it's, like, huge. I mean, it's the size of a book. Like, it's huge, the size of this new book I have sitting in front of me. And I think it was estimated for like $400 to $600, and it sold for $800,000 for a clock. And I mean, it was crazy. And like, it had come through the Caribbean, and like, that's where they like bought it. And then it like went down through these generations, and then it ended up in the hands of this family. And like, it was life changing for them.
And in case it's not abundantly clear to everybody listening, like, this is a clock made by Cartier that looks like a tortoise.
From the 20s.
Like, it's a giant turtle with a clock in it.
Then there was this one sale that was it was like a little tiny collection in a catalog, and it was like this gold nugget Vacheron clock. It was like a little tiny desk clock, and it was shaped like a gold nugget. And then they had a little Cartier envelope shutter watch, and it had the person's address and name written on it.
Love that.
I was like, oh, they need to make those again. But anyways, like this clock, like, and that was like the most rewarding side of the auction world. It was like this changed, this sale like changed this family's life. Like it really like, it changed their life.
Yeah.
And it was really, that was very rewarding. And they were there for the auction and they were emotional. That's awesome. And like, it was like a gratifying thing. And it was something that no one had ever seen before.
That's super cool.
And it was a random phone call. Like if we had been out of the office, like at lunch, like who knows? Like they would have called somewhere else.
Interesting.
So it really, that's what I mean when it comes down to luck. Like it really can be that straightforward. I mean, obviously hustling helps, but So that's my one story for that.
So we're going to make a semi-hard pivot here.
Pivot away.
We already touched on the fact that you had been at some events that Hodinkee had done back in the old days.
Yes.
So you were kind of, you were working at the auction house. You were part of the community. You were kind of a known person in the community.
Not really at
that
time.
Yeah, you were.
I was very unknown at that time.
That's all right. Luckily, we fixed that.
For better
or
worse.
How'd you end up at Hodinkee? Because I wasn't, to be clear, I was not there when you were hired at Hodinkee. It was the inter-Steven period.
The dark years.
It was the dark years. Ice age.
You guys, this is about Kara, not me. Come on. We can do this on my
episode. It was the ice age before I joined, too, so.
True.
Just kidding. Anyways, no, I started working at Hodinkee because I knew Ben because he used to come to our exhibitions, and he came to one of them, and he quietly mentioned that that Hodinkee was expanding. And I was like, oh, you know, like, okay. And I, like, went home, and I was like, oh, like, well, like, maybe I'll follow up on that. You know, maybe I'm looking for something new. So I followed up, and, you know, we met, and what I thought was going to be, like, an informational coffee, like, turned out to be kind of like an interview. And
Ben does that from time to time.
And then it was like, okay, cool, like, you want to work for us? And I was like, oh, sure. Like, oh, don't you want my resume? Like, I don't know. And so then, you know, a few months passed, and I started working at Hodinkee. But the funny thing about that was, is I didn't have a title when I started. So I didn't really know what I was doing when I started.
Titles are overrated.
Yeah, it was very confusing. I wasn't a writer by training. And I was like, you know, like, I don't know how to write. Like, I just write for catalogs. Like, it's very different. And he was like, yeah, yeah, you'll figure it out. And I was like, oh, okay. And so when I started, I was like, what do you guys need help with? And he was like, writing. And I was like, oh, shoot. I was like, all right, well, I guess I got to figure that out.
Buckle up.
So that was that. So I just started writing. And Jack joined like a month after I started. And that was in May 2015.
That was a big period of growth.
Yeah, it was. I was the fourth. There were four of us when I started. Yeah. And there were five. And then there were quickly 10. And then after that, it's just been kind of growing ever since. But yeah, I didn't know what I was doing at all.
But you figured it out.
But I figured, I mean, like, that's what people tell me.
I think it's safe to say you figured it out.
Sometimes I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, I think it's very safe to say you figured it out.
This journalism thing.
Yeah, but what did that process look like, kind of learning how to write journalistically, editorially?
Well,
asks the Northwestern journalism grad.
Do you, like, really want to know do you want to know the real answer? I would, like, write stories and, like,
tell us the fake answer.
Ben and Jack would be like, oh, they would, like, be editing, and they'd be like, oh, is that true? And I'd be like, I don't know. Like, just seemed right to me.
Fact-based was not all of
Kara missed the day in journalism school where they talked about fact-checking.
And I was like, no, like, that's what I just think that.
I got a gut feeling about this.
And Jack was like, yeah, you probably want to, like, double-check on that. Like, I don't think that's true. So I was like, ah. And then people would comment, and they'd be like, they would correct me in the comments. And, like, I remember there were, like, many... Disclaimer, there were many times I spent in the bathroom, like, crying over the comments.
Man.
Because I was like, oh my God, these people on the internet are so mean.
Yo,
but they were
so
right.
Shout out, if you're shitty in the comments, don't comment.
Yeah, FYI,
don't,
like,
be
you,
a jerk
people read them
in the comments.
But yeah, so I figured out pretty quickly that you needed to know your stuff and, like, be really, you know.
The highs and lows of a very informed and passionate, you know, readership.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so it was a steep learning curve. But there was one time, I remember it was before SIHH, my very first SIHH. And Ben came over to my desk and he plopped down like 20 press releases from like AP. And he was like, okay. He was like, we're going to SIHH in a few days and you need to get better at writing introducings really quickly. And he was like, so I need you to write all these introducings up and, like, you should time yourself. Ooh. And you should be able to write these in less than 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Training day. With
Ooh, I love
ben
it.
Clymer.
And I was like,
I love
excuse
efficiency.
Excuse me, what? It's like, less than 15 minutes? Do you know what a slow typer I am? I was like, I don't know about that. So I literally sat there and, like, would time myself and, like, write these press releases. And then he and Jack would edit them.
It's the Ben Clymer School of Journalism
what
right there.
What were you timing yourself with?
My phone, I think, because I didn't have a chronograph.
Oh, gray with the boo.
That's a good question, though. I didn't have a chronograph, so I would just sit there and time myself with my phone. But that was a good learning curve. And then I went to SIHH, and it was nothing like me sitting at my desk timing myself. It was actually terrifying because you really did have to get these things out so quickly. Because if you're not first, then, like, you're not.
I'm going to blow up Ben's spot real quick, my first SIHH. Ben's phone died overnight. He plugged it into the wall and the outlet, like, there was a problem with it, whatever. the phone died. And so it's my first day of SIHH. I've been working at the company for like 6 months. I still barely know anything about watches. I'm actually there with Greg Brown. Shout out Greg Brown.
Yo, yo.
And Ben just didn't show up that morning. And I was like, where is he? And he like wasn't answering his phone. I called the hotel and had them ring the room, and he slept through it.
That's so unlike him.
And like, it's super unlike him. And yeah, so I did my first two SIHH appointments with Greg Brown, actually, instead of with Ben.
Knowing Ben, that was probably intentional.
And they were AP.
He's probably trying to teach you.
It was AP and Longa. It was no joke.
Okay, JK probably wasn't intentional.
Yeah, it scared the shit out of me. But I think okay. I think we got through it. Yeah.
Did you see how high his voice went?
Yeah, that usually means you're lying.
I'm not super confident I did an amazing job, but okay, probably. We're all here. The business still exists, so thanks. We're all good. And
your first SIHH in Basel are scary.
They're terrifying.
I had no clue what I was walking into. It was terrifying.
Tell us about it.
I mean, it was just like, write this up, do this, edit these images. Oh, you have a meeting now? You're running around, you got your bags, you're like, you're trying to remember everything you've seen, everyone's asking all these questions, you're like, oh, I don't know, and you're like, read the press, and just get so stressful.
So, okay.
Yours was stressful, too.
Stressful, sure. I was kind of just more in awe of what I was looking at.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, you know, coming in very raw with very little understanding of how deep, wide, and kind of, you know, big this world is, and walking through the gates and into Hall 1 and just seeing multi-story structures, I think everyone has that kind of like first reaction.
It's crazy to realize how big the industry is because you don't know about it unless you know about it.
Right.
Right.
Like, none of my friends know about it. They don't get it. They're literally like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
What's this Basel?
Right.
And you kind of have to explain it.
For sure.
And they're like, God, that is crazy. And then you talked about like the community and how involved everybody is and how engaged everybody is. And they're like, wow, it's just like it's a different place. Like, you just don't know it unless you know it.
So how long were you at Hodinkee before SJPZ returned to the team?
I think I was there for a year and a half, maybe two.
Really?
Because I joined May 2015.
So like 15, 16 months, something like that. Because I came
Stevie
back.
Stevie knows the exact number of months.
I came back like end of July, early August 2016.
Yeah.
So can you give me the quick synopsis, not the quick synopsis, the overview of the pre-SJPZ era and then the post?
Interesting. Well, I was really excited for Stevie to come back.
I'd
only met him a couple times through SIHH and Basel. And, like, he was always very, like, fun and engaging. And, like, it was just really nice. So it was a little, you know, it was just me and Jack before Steven came back. So things were, like, a little wild. Like, it was, like,
it's true.
Someone who thought that they could just, like, put thoughts down and expect them to be facts.
Maybe run counter to Jack's expectations.
Yeah, like thinking about diamonds and stuff. And then you've got Jack talking about spring bars. And so like then Quartz Week happened. And like that was weird for everybody.
Quartz Week happened. We might bring that back, by the way.
I think we should.
It's the 50th anniversary of the Quartz Watch this year.
You're going to say the 50th anniversary of Quartz Watch.
It's the 50th anniversary of Quartz Week. Yeah.
So, too, I was like, oh, yeah.
Sorry, guys.
No, so it was just the two of us. So it was like it was a slog. So when Steven came back, Steven's clearly the most organized out of the three of us. So
I'll
like
take that.
I was like,
I'm not going to argue with
like
that
someone
one.
Here, someone is here to organize the calendar and like help us like keep things moving on this side of things. So it was a little bit more, I'll say free flowing pre Stevie, and then a little bit more organized post Stevie.
Mm-hmm.
But Stevie came back guns blazing.
He
was ready. He was at the ready to come back and take over.
Coming in hot.
Yeah,
is
came
the,
in so hot.
Stevie P move.
Well, I'll make the quick note that the bromance between these two for the audience out there.
I like that it's called a bromance, too.
Because what else would it be?
We share a desk for people who don't know. Our desks are in these like pods that face each other. So Kara and I literally face each other all day, every day.
With computers in front of us.
Yeah. Well, occasionally, sometimes you stand up and film me over both of our computers.
I just like to check in.
That's fine. I respect that.
It's a beautiful yin and yang kind of thing.
Yeah. We're very different people, but we work well together.
It's very true. Right.
What are some highlights from your professional relationship, like the work that you two have put out together that you're the most proud of?
I have to. I'll go first.
Go for it.
I think the Senza Luna story was when Stevie and I really like established our like working relationship, because he was so helpful and instrumental in me writing that story the best way that I could. And like, I really am a, like, I don't sound good unless Stevie edits my story.
All right. Sorry, everybody. Due to a technical difficulty, our mics drop out for a few seconds right here. What you're missing is Kara talking about why the Senza Luna story was important to her development as a journalist, and why it means so much to her. What you're going to hear in a second is me jumping back in, talking about kind of what this story meant to Hodinkee and what it means to the watch community at large.
Money in a smarter way with more confidence, and that grows the confidence of the whole watch market and kind of does away with a lot of the sort of like cloak and dagger behind the scenes foggy facts kind of world is not just a good thing for people who are interested in the Senza Luna. It's a good thing for the whole watch market. It makes the whole market act with more confidence, and it makes the whole market feel safer and feel like a better place for people to put their money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good, again, not just for people buying Senza Lunas, but for anyone interested in watches. And to be able to put a story together like that, like, that didn't just change the market for the Senza Luna, it changed the watch market. And we've heard that from, you know, folks at the auction houses, both positively and negatively. But, like, it essentially put an end to 20 or 30 years of, like, probably bunk scholarship on that watch. Yeah. And, like, that's a cool thing to be able to do.
Yeah, it was, that was crazy. That was cool. But the funny thing about that is that then the one came up for auction after, and in a way it did well because it became like a novelty.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you know? But like not because of its like value, but because of the fact that it was like
completely
questionable.
Yeah.
Which was weird. But I had fun with that story.
I think a similar story for me, and the other one I was going to mention, is the Paul Newman story that you did for the first volume of the magazine. I mean, it was the cover story for the first volume of the Hodinkee magazine, which is something that, you know, Ben and I had been talking about doing since, what, 2012? You know, it was essentially 5 years in the making.
Yeah.
And the cover story was this really incredible story of what happened behind the scenes with the Paul Newman that you put together.
Yeah.
And the amount of, like, actual reporting done, like, most of what we do on a daily basis does not require a ton of, like, old school gumshoe kind of, like, making phone calls, tracking down paperwork, reporting.
Those are my
And it shows. I mean, like that, the Senza Luna and the Paul Newman are in many ways, you know, birds of a feather.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's another one I'm super proud of. And in all the reporting that everybody else did, there were lots of great stories written about the Paul Newman Daytona. I think we are the only people who published, and you are the only person who wrote a real story about how that watch came to be, why it's important, and how it ended up where it ended up. You sort of wrote around the object in a really interesting way. And you got a lot of people who, like,
I know.
Stevie,
no, for
blood.
Real though.
Also that,
like,
but like you and Ben were instrumental in,
but it's like all journalism
well,
is a
so.
Team effort, right?
Yeah.
Like,
for sure.
Yeah.
You have to talk things through in order to really
but
get
you,
the story out there. But that
know,
story was controversial. People were upset.
Yeah. And like, mm-hmm. again, the benefit of sitting across from you is like, I got to hear those phone calls, and you were able to get a lot of people who did not want to talk on the record to say things. And that's not easy.
So for people who were not witnessing Kara put together either of those stories, can we choose one of those to kind of do a biopsy? Biopsy? Biopsy on?
Sure. Autopsy.
Autopsy?
I'm going to restate that. For those... what is a biopsy?
It's when
biopsy
you take
like
a tissue sample.
Yes, take a tissue sample.
Yeah. Let's make sure it's not cancerous.
A closer look.
For those who were not behind the scenes on that one, I think we should get an autopsy on one of those stories.
Like Senza how they Luna came, or like Paul how they Newman. Happened?
Yeah, from the beginning. From
yeah,
the
you
top.
Pick.
So for the, you know, the Paul Newman was pretty straight. It wasn't straightforward. It was, everybody knew this watch existed. And then there were certain people I knew I needed to call, and Ben helped me with that, and you helped me with that as well. So I, you know, on exact. So I called those people and talked to them. And I actually got a lot of practice through the Senza Luna. So I'll talk about that one in particular. But that was weird because I remember, so like Ben sent me a link and he was like, this is a weird watch. You should look at it. And I was like, okay. And I was like, I love the 3448. I was like, what is this thing? This is so weird, so cool. And so I started doing digging, and like, he didn't know. He literally was like, this is like a really rare thing that you should kind of research. And so I looked into it, and I called, who did I call first? I think I called John Reardon. And he was like, yeah, like, I can't really say anything.
John Reardon, who at the time and still is head of Christie's.
Christie's, yeah. And he was like, yeah, like, and I don't know, this is like a really weird watch. Yeah, like, I, you know, like, it's kind of rare, and like, I don't really have much to say about it. Okay. So then I like kind of went down the list of like experts and other auction house specialists, and people were like, I like, I'm not going on the record, blah, 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 blah. And I was just like, okay. And then I went to you, and you're like, yeah, that's weird. Like, you should kind of like dig a little further. And that's when I like dissected all the movement numbers. I went through all the sales of every single one that happened. I created a spreadsheet of like when they were sold, movement numbers, when they were sold.
I love a story that involves a spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm. What they sold for, and like all this stuff. And it just kind of like nothing really added up. And it was just very, and I can't really say on the podcast like what people did tell me, but like it was very weird. And so like it was just kind of like, okay, like,
there's like some antimatter. Something's
going
like
on here
that's
like not normal. And like, yeah, like I got some calls after it was published where it was like, I can't believe you said that. And I was like, I didn't really say anything. So I always find myself in the most controversial stories.
There's like it's this, good though.
There's like the Steve McQueen watch, the Paul Newman.
The Steve McQueen's another one that
I'm like, everyone's like, oh, this watch like might be weird. And I'm like, cool, I'll take it.
I think it points to something that you're good at and that you've really developed as a skill. And like, you know, it's not an easy thing, especially in this world, but like you're good at getting people to feel like they can
comfortable enough to share stuff with
yeah,
you. People and overshare with me all
no,
the
but
time.
Exactly. But like as
I
a journalist,
ask for directions.
as a journalist, that's good though, right? Like you are able to get people to say things on the record or even on background just to give you the right info. In a way that, like, if I made that phone call, like, they would tell me to hang the fuck up. Like, there's no way I'm going to get that story.
Yeah. I think I was new enough to where people, like, didn't... I don't think people took me seriously enough to think that I was actually going to do anything with that information. And then I did. And I think people now are kind of like, oh, like, maybe I won't give you that information.
You think that's what it was?
I don't
think so.
Because I'm thinking back to the last editor interview with one Joe Thompson, and people knew very well where that information was going to end up. But there's a certain quality that Joe has that I don't think is,
Joe.
You know,
King
it's quite the same in you, but the same kind of like charm that people are willing to share with you.
I agree.
You invite the information.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, guys.
And I think people also trust that you're going to be respectful about it. That,
of
like,
course.
Even if they disagree ultimately with what you publish, like they know you're not going to make them look like assholes, which is a huge thing. Like,
that's
when you're talking to a source, like, they just don't want to sound like idiots or like jerks. And so if you can make them feel comfortable and like they're in good hands, you can get more information. And that's important. Like, you can't do this job without that skill.
No, I think it's important to be sensitive to how other people are perceived. But I also think it's important to tell the truth and live in reality.
Yeah.
But it was funny because Gray and I... another highlight was Gray and I worked on the Paul Newman part two, which was the video, which
Of the Paul Newman.
Oh, that was stressful because that was like 2 weeks of just like, we only have one shot to get this and like, figure this out. And I remember we were at the auction and someone came up to me and mentioned the magazine story and they basically were like, you need to be careful. Like,
oof.
About what you say.
Like in a threatening way?
It was cloaked. It was
not,
a cloaked.
Not threatening?
Yeah, it was not threatening. And I just remember being like, what the fuck? I was like, this is watches, everybody. Like, we're not saving lives. Like, let's relax. Like, it was very strange. That actually really threw me off.
Yeah, I don't like that.
It was really
I don't like
bad.
That either.
Yeah, you were busy with the cameras filming stuff. And I was just like
classic
waiting.
Gray.
Yeah. He was like doing his job. And I was just like walking around. And someone said that to me and I was like, huh. I was like, all right, well, I think I like called my parents in tears or something. I was like, oh, this is really something.
Should have just texted Will.
Tears
Holloway.
Are like a common theme.
Will
hot
would
tears,
not.
Hot
Will
takes.
Would have taken care of that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, Will would not suffer that.
But it was fine. After the fact, that was another doozy, that story, but that was fun. It was also hard to get information out of people on that one because they were so the media training behind that watch was just insane.
Yeah.
I felt. Which meant the publicist, love you, Paul Lerner, did a good job. That's the thing. This job is fun. Like, I feel very lucky. So.
I agree.
We do cool things, and I feel hashtag blessed about that.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to ask
this
one.
Is getting emo.
One more question, and then we'll
emo?
Let you go, because I know.
Getting emo.
You got a birthday dinner to go to.
Yeah, I do.
I don't want to keep you too long.
It's okay.
But while we finish sipping our Savvy B, we'll.
That's why it's getting so emo.
Yeah, it's all right. It's good. It's wine time with.
That's
sorry,
your,
guys.
That's
going to be your. Sorry to all the listeners.
No, that's going
to
be your spin-off show.
Story.
Wine time with Cara Barrett.
Or her rapper name, Savvy B.
It's okay, wine time.
Fine. She's doing a little dance, guys. You guys are missing this dance. I'm sure this is great radio, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, you
sure.
guys hate us. That's fine.
I want to know what's the sort of like untapped potential that you see? Like, what's the thing you want to do that's sitting out there? Like, the story you want to write or the project you want to engage in? Like, what's the thing you want to do? And we actually...
I don't have an answer for that.
We haven't even touched on the fact that now, in addition to being an editor and doing our social media...
Oh, yes. Hashtag special projects.
You also do special projects, which means, like, you're the one who shepherds the limited editions through yeah. and a whole bunch of other things, but maybe we save that for CB round two.
I can talk a lot if we want to do a second episode.
We can do that for
no,
sure.
I'm kidding. Yeah. No, I do a lot of, yeah, the special projects and things like that, which it's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff, which I really enjoy. So
yeah.
That's fun. But.
But do you have something out there, like a story you want to write or a project you want to do or a watch you want to chase down that is out there? Something in the future of CB that we have to look forward to?
Honestly, there's nothing out there that I know of yet. And I think that's kind of the beauty of being an editor. And it's like, or a journalist, whatever you want to call it. It's like the stories kind of just happen and you have to jump on them quickly and you have to have to deal with them as they come. So there's no particular story that I'm like chasing. There's no like folklore, and like The Sensalune is a good example of that. And then Paul Newman, like it just kind of like happened and you just have to like go with it. But I think that's what's so exciting about this job is kind of everything's new and everything's changing and everything just kind of pops up and you just roll with it and you figure it out as it comes. And it's a good learning experience, and I'm here to learn. Like, that's what I want in my life, is to, like, keep learning. And so I feel like I'm in the right spot for that now, and that's kind of, that's my answer.
Perfect. Should we do a little Hodinkee questionnaire?
Yeah, do it.
Do like an amended one?
I'll throw some stuff in at the end.
Okay.
Yeah,
oh,
we'll do the standard questions, and then we'll do a couple special.
Can I get a couple special questions?
Oh.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pressure's on.
I'll do some
sure.
Thinking.
All right. So, we'll start off with the normal questions. What's a watch that's caught your eye recently?
Hmm. Okay, well, besides the Rainbow Day.
Yeah, can we talk about the fact that we have made it 50-something minutes into this episode? Maybe 60-something minutes with no rainbows?
Maybe we do like an addendum.
Addendum? All right. We'll do an appendix, the rainbow appendix.
We'll do a biopsy.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that Day-Date was really pretty. So I do love that one. But I know a lot of people are talking about that Timex Q.
Dude, the Timex Q is dope.
It's hot. People want it. And I think that's kind of fun. I like it when something like that, where it's just kind of under the radar and it just
agreed.
Pops up on your screen and then everybody's all over it.
Agreed.
So that's, yeah.
All right.
That's one.
It's the best place you've traveled in the last year. Hmm. And if you don't say Basel World with me, you're in big trouble.
Where is the best place I've traveled? Arizona.
Oh, interesting.
So little known fact, or maybe big known fact, I don't know, is the Hodinkee shop sponsors Copper State 1000.
Yeah.
And so I, as special projects, oversee all of our sponsorships and partnerships, and was able to go on the rally, which is a vintage car rally through Arizona for 1,000 miles, and it was so cool to see that part of the country.
It's beautiful.
In that, and Gray's been as well. He went a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a cool part of the country that you just don't get to see that often. I went as a kid, but like I didn't appreciate it, obviously, because I was like 9. And going back and seeing the Grand Canyon and like all the mountains and the desert and like the fact that you can go from like one to the other in like 2 hours is just crazy.
You had seen the Grand Canyon before?
I had not.
Ooh.
It's like 2D. It's 2D. No one tells you that. It's 2D.
Yeah, I have the exact same impression.
It's insane.
It is so big that your brain can't comprehend the vastness of it, so it looks flat.
It's flat.
You can't perceive the depth.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's insane.
If you haven't seen the Grand Canyon, go check it out.
Grand Canyon?
Check out the Grand Canyon.
All right. Sweet.
Pro tip, check out the Grand Canyon.
All right. Next question. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given, and who gave it to you?
Okay, so it's two pieces of advice from the same person.
Okay, you're cheating, but that's okay.
Okay. My grandmother on my paternal side always used to say, people are people. And I never really got it because, like, you know, whatever. She had this, like, she's from New York. She has this thick accent. People are people. That's how she would say it. She's like this tiny little bird lady. And she used to say it growing up. And she would say it so much. And it's, like, burned in my brain, all my cousins' brains. And, like, I'm just like, what? People are people. Like, what is that? And now that I'm older and I work with, like, a lot of different types of people, I'm like, yeah, people are people. Like, you can't control
people. Great. I think that means we're people?
No, but you can't control people, and you can't, like, they're going to be who they're going to be. And, like, you have no control over that.
Totally.
So you just have to, like, let it go. And then another thing she used to say is keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
And that's also true.
Great.
The simpler, the better. So that's my two pieces of advice.
So what's your guilty pleasure?
Bravo TV.
Yeah, baby.
All of them, every day, all day, every day. Vanderpump Rules, Real Housewives.
Southern Charm's back.
Southern Charm is back, based in Charleston, where I'm from.
Wasn't your sister on Southern Charm?
My sister was on it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My sister made a cameo on Southern Charm. She's friends with one of the characters or one of the people. And so, yeah, I was like watching it and I was like, oh, there's Grace. And I like texted her and I was like, hey, you're on Southern Charm. She's like, yeah, I know. I was like, oh, okay. Like, don't you think you want to, like, tell us? And my mom was like, oh, my God, she didn't tell me. And she's, like, trying to find it and, like, all this stuff. And I was just like, oh, okay.
We'll link that up.
Yeah.
Link it. Yeah.
Great. How are we going to get on Vanderpump Rules?
I don't care because I'm not going on that show.
Oh, come on. I thought you'd be all for it.
Gray should go on Southern Charm. I feel like he would fit better into that vibe.
Okay. We'll talk to your sister about it.
Yeah, we'll just keep saying okay over and over again. Yeah.
I don't want to, like,
what are your questions, Gray?
Yeah, what are your questions?
I had such a good one. Oh, name three things that you and Stevie P have in common.
Oh, okay. I like this.
Hmm.
It's go time.
Sobby B.
We do both love white wine. That's
both
true.
Have Sobby B in your systems right now.
Vanderpump Rules.
We do both love garbage TV.
And, it's certainly not order. Stevie loves order.
Although you got that new notepad with the calendar on it. Ooh, I love that.
He's so jealous.
Yeah, I kind of am.
Scented candles.
Ooh, we do love a good scented candle. Yeah. Our desk
has a scented candle.
Always the best smelling desk
so
in the office.
The three. There we go.
All right.
That was a good one.
Okay. I'll take that. You got any more, Gray?
I have a whole list of them, but, you know, I think we can move right along.
Okay.
How about this? Share an embarrassing moment of your Hodinkee tenure with our audience.
Ooh.
Okay. So the first time I met John Mayer, he came into the office and I was walking to go, he was talking to Ben and I was walking to go get water. And Ben was like, oh, Kara, this was like 3 years ago. He was like, oh, Kara, meet John. And I was like, hi, nice to meet you. And he was like, oh, I love your Instagram. And I was like, great. And I just turned and walked back to my desk.
Smooth move.
Just like deadpan was like, great.
Man, Kara's so cool, like, Gray.
And Ben was like, could you be more rude? And I was like, I didn't know what to say.
That was the end of the conversation.
And that was
it. Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Great. He's been very nice ever since, but I was actually, it was, and then I got to my desk and I was like, great.
Great. Cool.
Great. Two thumbs up.
All right. Let's go to cultural recommendations. We got to get you out of here.
Oh,
cultural recommendations. On your birthday, what's the thing that you think everybody should go look at?
Okay, well, running with the theme of TV, because I love TV.
Great.
Chernobyl is such a good show.
Oh, is it good?
It's so good.
Ugh.
So, fun fact, I was born a month after Chernobyl in Switzerland. And my mom told me, growing up, that they were concerned about A, the fumes passing over Switzerland and contaminating the babies, and B, their cows. because they didn't want the cows to eat the radioactive grass and therefore put it in their milk, chocolate, so on and so forth. But it's such a good show.
So Switzerland worried about babies and cows.
Yes, those are their two top concerns.
It's weird that that's my takeaway from that. But yeah.
Yeah, well, you know.
Gray, what are we looking at here?
I will recommend a video series that Pitchfork produces called Over Under. And I thought it was kind of like a more ubiquitous thing until I referenced a few of the episodes to Hodinkee colleagues and they had no idea what I was talking about. Over Under is basically Pitchfork sits down musicians, celebrities, people from the zeitgeist and asks them whether things are overrated or underrated.
Hmm. You know, I like that.
Anything from, pop culture to philosophical concepts, etc.
So good.
It is so good. I would start with a recent episode featuring Bob Saget.
Oh, I have not seen that one.
It is low-key a disaster, but the most beautiful kind of like, you know.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, plane crash you've ever seen. So start with that and then work your way in whatever direction your YouTube recommendations take
you. The Rick Ross one is.
Rick Ross is a personal favorite of mine.
Oh, wow. Okay, I have to watch that.
Over under.
All right, I'm going to recommend two records, one new, one old. The new record is I Am Easy to Find by The National. It's the new National record. It's really good. Like, every time they put an album out, I'm worried that it's going to be terrible and it's going to be finally the end of The National being great. But as, like, a white boy with a lot of feelings, I think it continues to land for me. I heavily recommend the new National record. And then kind of along the same theme, I'll recommend, since we talked about Texas already, I'm going to recommend, go back, and if you haven't listened to it in a while, go listen to Gimme Fiction by Spoon. That album's amazing.
I thought you were going to recommend a Garth Brooks album.
Nah, Spoon, great Austin band. Gimme Fiction, amazing, amazing record. I've probably listened to it at least once a week for years, and I continue to love it, and I've been really into it lately. So
there you go.
Check it out. Shot. Gimme Fiction. Yeah. Awesome. CB, thank you for joining us.
Thanks
it's your
for
birthday.
Having me. I hope I didn't bore everybody.
I do not think you bored anybody.
Well, we were a little over the place. A little bit over.
Sorry, guys.
I think that's a reflection on the three of us, though.
Sure.
Yeah.
If the three of us recorded an episode that wasn't all over the place, I'd be kind of worried about it.
For sure. I love you both. This has been great.
Yeah.
It's been fun.
Same.
Thanks, guys.
Have a good birthday.
Thanks.
Go have a fun dinner.
Thanks.
Have a couple cocktails.
Yeah.
See you soon.
All right. Bye.
And we out.
Guys, that was awesome.
Was that good?
This week's episode was recorded at Mirror Tone Studios in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you, and see you next week.